Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What happens to business when a country is in chaos? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, August 15th. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. The situation in Egypt has gotten more violent and more precarious. More than 600 people have died. President Obama canceled joint military exercises scheduled to start next month. And the U.S. government is urging Americans in Egypt to leave the country. Many big businesses there are shutting down operations as well. And the curfew means that local businesses have dramatically shorter hours. Reporter Kimberly Adams is joining us again from Cairo. Kimberly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There are reports of businesses pulling out of Egypt. GM is closing their site there. They're pulling workers out. Do we have a sense of what effect that's going to have?
It's going to have a big effect because it's not just GM. I mean, so far I've heard about GM, Toyota, Royal Dutch Shell, and the Swedish home appliance maker Electrolux. All of them have at least temporarily suspended operations and closed their facilities here in Cairo, saying that they're worried about their employees. Many of them say they plan on reopening in a couple of days, but that has practical implications for people living here. First of all, these companies employ thousands of people, and so that means thousands of people aren't going to work. And they don't really have the same kind of labor rules that we have here, and so it's not clear whether or not those people are still going to be getting their salaries. Also, with the curfew and people commuting like we talked about yesterday, it's difficult for these companies to be sure that their employees can even come to work, and so it's costing them money as well.
How much business do American companies and multinationals actually do in Egypt?
I mean, if you think about a company like Calvin Klein, for example, has a big factory in which they make clothing and cotton apparel here. A lot of the companies that Americans will recognize, like Pirelli Tires, have factories here. And again, companies like GM and Toyota, even though Toyota is not an American company, it does have a big factory here. And it's not just these big businesses that are being hit or affected. I actually spoke to Wasim El-Tanahi. He's the managing director of Media Republic, which runs a lifestyle website called Cairo 360. It's like a Yelp for Egypt. And he said that because Egyptian businesses have had so many of these curfews and protests, they've really learned that they have to be nimble.
It comes at big expense for a lot of companies. Ours is no exception. People try and think on their feet. Decisions are literally made from hour to hour. What time should we open? Something which might open from 5 p.m. till the middle of the night now opens from 10 a.m. till 5 or 6 p.m. whenever the curfew is. So it really keeps people on their toes. It's not a pleasant experience, but it's a necessary evil these days, unfortunately.
He says that not only is it the opening and closing that causes problems, but it's also the distraction of staff. He pointed out that he now has to let his staff go early, and while they're at work, maybe they're distracted because they're hearing about things happening on the street or they're worried about how they're going to be able to get home through protests. But at the same time, his way of adapting to what's going on is to point out ways that people can get around it. So, for example, on the Cairo 360 website today, they posted a list of all of these restaurants and grocery stores and their curfew hours, including some restaurants that are still delivering after the curfew.
Egypt has a pretty big nighttime economy that's very different from the way companies and small businesses work here in the U.S. Explain that to me a little bit.
So, for example, he was mentioning that some businesses might be open until 12 o'clock at night, and now suddenly they have to close at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. And so that means, you know, if you don't open until the afternoon, you're losing more than half of your business in a day. So what are you going to do? Lots of people like to go out and sit at coffee shops that run late into the evening. A lot of people do their shopping in the evening. Because Cairo is such a huge city and a lot of people have really long commutes, times, sometimes people just can't do their shopping and their errands until late in the evening. But now they're all stuck at home.
Kimberly Adams, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
On Wall Street today, down, down, down. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Here are two data points on how the housing market is doing. We've got low interest rates, and it can be hard to get a mortgage. Okay, here's data point number three. It turns out that for half of the homes bought last year, financing didn't matter because the buyers paid cash. Yes, cash. A report from Goldman Sachs says that all cash sales have more than doubled over the last 7 years. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports on what that means for the recovery.
Several factors led to the rise in the cash-for-home business. One is the glut of cheap housing following the foreclosure crisis. Another is the tightening of lending guidelines. Darren Bloomquist is with Realty Track.
This market by nature is just much more attractive, conducive to cash buyers.
Cash buyers can be hedge funds, retirees, or foreign buyers. Realty Track recently put out a report that said that more than 50% of June home sales were cash sales in Nevada, Florida, and New York. In Vermont, it was 80%. So what does this mean for the recovery in these places? Bloomquist says it could make these markets more stable.
There's not the risk down the road for foreclosure because they're purchasing with cash and not financing those purchases.
This trend has also led to the rise of the single-family rental. Steve Cook with Real Estate Economy Watch says many of these houses are being occupied by families who were foreclosed on or who see their rental as a stepping stone to owning.
So it's just like living in a nice house in a nice neighborhood with the schools and whatever else amenities that a young family might need, except that instead of paying a mortgage, you're paying a rental.
Christopher Mayer is with the National Bureau of Economic Research. He says cash buyers have had an effect on the housing market.
The cash buyers have definitely helped put a floor on the housing market and start picking up prices.
But Mayer says it's unclear what the long-term impact will be in neighborhoods where the balance has shifted from owner-occupied to rentals. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
The world's biggest retailer reported earnings today, and it wasn't pretty. Walmart said sales were down and cut its profit forecast for the year. The company blamed higher gas prices and payroll taxes. But you can use Walmart as a little window into what middle to lower income consumers are, and in this case, aren't buying. So we sent Stacey Vanek Smith to peek into some shopping carts.
The journey to the center of a Walmart shopping cart will be shorter than it used to be, says Brian Yarbrough, an analyst at Edward Jones. Overall, customers are buying less. What are they buying?
New T-shirts or some new underwear, but as far as stretching and buying some new pants and, you know, nicer shirt, I just don't think they're doing it.
So in the cart, absolutely have to have clothes, also some home necessities. Out of the cart?
Electronics didn't perform, toys didn't perform, sporting goods, seasonal didn't perform.
So don't expect to see bicycles, Xboxes, or patio furniture. And don't expect to find a lot of produce in a Walmart cart, says retail analyst Kevin Koop.
People who are cash-strapped tend to turn away from fresh foods. They will tend to buy more packaged goods.
Koop says Walmart's recent push to offer more fruits and vegetables was ill-timed. Analyst Brian Yarbrough says you'll spot some surprises in a Walmart cart.
It's like, you wouldn't think Snapper mowers and Weber grills would be doing well, but they are.
That's because low-income shoppers tend to splurge and scrimp, says Chris Christopher, a consumer analyst at IHS Global Insight.
They might say, okay, I want this one piece of luxury, but then they'll hang back on buying, say, middle-tier clothing.
The other thing about a Walmart cart, it might not be a cart at all, says Citigroup analyst Deborah Weinswig. Offline, Walmart's the discount king, but online, it's losing lots of carts to retailers like Amazon. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Small businesses are feeling just a little more confident about the economy these days. A report from the National Federation of Independent Business says they may be ready to hire a few more workers. Marketplace's Adrian Hill went out to talk to two new store owners about why they set up shop and what they hope is ahead.
This is the story of two new store owners on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, following their passions with big ambitions for what's next. And I should warn you, it's sweet. Sticky sweet. It starts appropriately with 15 chocolate chip cookies.
Ooey gooey delicious cookies.
Going in the oven. Courtney Cowan is the owner of Milk Jar Cookies. She's also the person who makes all the cookies.
it was just kind of the one thing that I excelled at. You know, I can make a cake and I can make a, you know, bar, but there's nothing special about them. Whereas there's something special about the cookies.
She and her husband, Adam, quit their jobs in the entertainment industry and in April opened this cookie and milk store where a cookie will set you back $3 and you can order a glass of milk to go with it. They pieced together the money they needed to open with a small business loan and family and their savings.
Since 2005, I'd been doing an online company, Cookies, and always had this as the end goal. And it just took time and confidence.
Courtney says so far, things have gone better than they expected. They now have 6 part-time employees. 2 just started this week. Perhaps as a sign of the still struggling economy, she got upwards of 100 applications for those jobs. But she's hopeful for what's next.
I would like in 5 years to have 1 or 2 more locations, I think. We would like to grow beyond just this space and be able to serve people of other areas.
A quick walk down Wilshire, past a couple salons and women's clothing stores, past a Staples and a beauty supply store, and you get to Miracle Mile Toys and Games. Christine Johnson opened this toy store in March after a whole lot of thinking about it and posting on Facebook.
Once I wrote out the story of my dream on Facebook and had all the support from my friends and family going back years, you know, childhood friends, I sort of thought, all right, well, now I have to do this.
There's no boy aisle or girl aisle here. There are almost no toys that take batteries. There are squeaking toys and rattles. Christine wasn't able to get a bank loan to open. She didn't have any experience with retail.
The store is completely funded by myself and my husband and our savings and our credit cards and just bootstrapping it, I guess.
When I ask her if she's nervous, if the risk stresses her out, she says no, not really.
I don't mind the risk. It's exciting, and after all, if you don't take some risks, you're never going to get any rewards back.
5 months after opening, she's feeling good. She's thinking already about another location. She's hired 3 part-time employees for this store.
I wish I could have my employees full-time, because they are great, and I know they could all use the full-time work. And I think down the line, that's something we'll do. I'd love to offer them health insurance and all the rest.
But for now, that's got to be in the future plans. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up,
lots of variety and lots more consumer ego and identity.
A look at why the beer market has real staying power. But first, let's do the numbers. Stock and bond prices usually move in opposite directions. Today, they both fell. The Dow Jones Industrial Average sank 225 points, or 1.5%, and closed at 15,112. The NASDAQ fell 63 points, 1.7%, to end at 3606. The S&P 500 lost 24 points, 1.4%. It finished at 1661. The irony is the day started with good jobs and housing news, but that only made investors worry that the Fed will let interest rates rise. Poor corporate results also weighed on stocks. As we told you earlier, Walmart is the latest retailer to disappoint. Its shares surrendered 2.6%. Cisco reversed 7% after announcing it would cut 4,000 jobs. Big bank stocks were down across the board, as were markets overseas. In Tokyo, the Nikkei fell 2.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.77%. That's the highest level in 2 years. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for July. The first issue of Sports Illustrated hit newsstands on August 16, 1954. It wasn't the swimsuit edition. And break out your bows, bangles, and fingerless gloves. Madonna turns 55. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Every time you go on the internet, type in an address, you're using my next guest's work. He runs ICANN. That's the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. They're sort of like global air traffic control for the internet. .com, .org, all of that is getting a major overhaul. Fadi Shahadi is the ICANN CEO. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
Right now, I'm familiar with typing in marketplace.org or amazon.com. Explain the change that is going on here.
There's a major change coming. What's to the right of the dot is called the top-level domain. We're all familiar with .com, .org, .edu, etc. There's 22 of them today. 8 years ago, all of our stakeholders decided, why restrict these? Why should it be only these 22? What if I wanted to have O'Leary, .O'Leary, and sell anything in front of it or make it available to my family, to my friends? And so the community decided to open up the system and allow anything to go after the dot. Also, more importantly, they decided that it doesn't have to be in Latin, that this could be in Chinese script or Arabic script or Cyrillic, therefore enabling people who may not even have an English keyboard to actually type a full address in another name. So we're opening that and removing a constraint that frankly shouldn't even exist, so that people can have any name, any address in any script around the planet.
I mean, isn't some of this going to be kind of confusing? I mean, I can barely remember half of the sites I'm trying to go to. If I'm going to .apple instead of apple.com, how does this not become a big mess?
Many people have contended it might. But as we've discovered in so many areas, choice at the beginning may cause a little bit of confusion. But we believe right now, from all the studies we've done, that choice will bring a lot more variety, a lot more diversity, and a lot more opportunity.
It sounds like it will also bring a lot more money if you're talking about opening up new markets. Certainly when you talk about China, when you talk about India, these are growing economies where people want to get on the web.
Oh, yeah. We only have 2 billion people on the web today. By enabling this massive expansion of the address system, there is no doubt that this will create a lot more opportunity for businesses here and in the new emerging markets.
You've had some bumps in the road. Amazon wanted .amazon, and some Latin American countries said, nuh-uh. Mm. And Chrysler wanted .ram for their truck. You had some objections from India, where the Hindu god Ram is obviously a very big deal. How do you police this?
You're touching on a very difficult area for us. The reality is, when you allow people to brand spaces on the internet, you're going to have conflict. We have to understand the law and follow the law, but at the same time, allow all voices to be heard. And consensus is hard. I grew up in Beirut, where we had, 18 different factions that constantly had to find consensus, and it's not easy. But it's actually the sane way forward for the internet.
Say I want to get .Lizzie or .O'Leary. How much does that cost me? How do I do it?
So in this first round, it would have cost you an application fee of close to $200,000, which obviously leaves many people out. Now, as we go to round two, which everyone is clamoring for us to open, we will reassess the costs. We are a nonprofit, and therefore, if the learnings from this first round lead us to a different fee, and hopefully, I hope personally, a lower fee, so more people can participate, we will adjust that as we go.
Fadi Shahadi, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Okay, Americans, do you know what the beautiful game is? Soccer. And this Saturday, NBC starts betting big money that you'll watch it. NBC's cable sports network will start airing soccer games from the English Premier League. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler translates it for us.
The exposure of many Americans to international soccer can be summed up in one word. NBC execs hope U.S. sports fans will like soccer more when it comes in a British package.
Oh, wonderful! Brilliant! Fantastic free kick!
Over the next year, NBC Sports Network will air around 1,600 hours of soccer programming. Gabe Feldman directs Tulane University's sports law program.
It's certainly a risk worth taking because every network out there is looking to fill some airtime with live sports programming, and this might be the next great frontier for them.
Others are more skeptical of the $250 million NBC spent on the deal.
I'm not sure if it makes sense financially.
Michael Cordy is a senior equity analyst at Morningstar. He doesn't buy the hype about soccer becoming the next big thing.
I've heard that for 10 or 20 years.
But Cordy says the move makes more sense as a way for NBC to grow its cable sports brand.
A lot of the quality, highly viewed sports programming is tied up in long-term contracts. The soccer was a set of rights that was available.
If soccer mania finally takes off, NBC has a winner. If not, soccer may be just a placeholder until more popular sports programming becomes available. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We have some sad, sad news. A great American industry is declining. Yes. We are drinking less beer. Nancy Kane of Harvard Business School is here to help us work through it. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Americans are drinking less beer, right? Tell me about this.
So, Gallup's annual alcohol survey came out last week, and what that showed is that although Americans prefer beer, 36% love beer better than other alcoholic beverages, the growth of Americans' preference for beer is declining. It's not very dramatic. It's been happening for a while. But, you know, there is very good indication that Americans are, if you will, broadening their alcoholic palate. And I think that's really what the bottom line is amidst a lot of dramatic noise.
Right. So rumors of the death of beer have been greatly exaggerated, do you think?
Absolutely. And if you take the numbers, so beer is a $100 billion market. Wine is about a $35 billion market. And spirits is about a $62 billion market. So added up, we got $200 billion that we're spending on alcohol. That's, you know, that's two sequesters. It's a big, big market.
Who's drinking beer? Who's drinking wine? How does it shake out demographically?
It shakes out in some sense in the way you'd expect. So for Americans over 50, wine is the preferred drink. For Americans between the ages of 18 and 29, beer is still the preferred drink. What's really interesting is that all the excitement in the beer market is, and this perhaps isn't a big surprise, is in the niche but very fast-growing market for craft beers.
Right.
I just read that there are now more breweries in America, and that's 2,538 as of June, than there have been in this country since 1870. So we're having a beer renaissance at the craft beer level.
Where do you see growth coming from next? Are we going to keep drinking, you know, boutique beer? Is it going to be in wine? Is it going to be in bourbon?
You know, really, Lizzie, that's a great question. It's really in all three sectors if you think about it. You know, take vodka, for example. When I was in college, we were drinking cranberry juice and vodka, you know, Long Island iced teas. But we weren't talking about, well, I want this particular kind of Grey Goose, right? Well, consumer knowledge has come to all these games. You know, higher value-added evolution with lots of variety and lots more consumer ego and identity invested in these kind of products than saying, I'll have a Bud, please, and I don't like a lot of foam.
All right, Nancy, so I have to ask you, are you a beer drinker? Are you a wine drinker? Something else? What grabs you?
I've always been a beer drinker. And I was a Michelob drinker, so this will date me, back in college. And in recent years, I have done what I am, you know, talking about lots and lots of Americans doing, and that is I have migrated to a series of craft beers. Give me a good IPA in lots of shapes and sizes on a hot summer day, and yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Well, hopefully you can enjoy one after the show.
I hope so.
Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, thank you so much.
A real pleasure, Lizzie.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note is about truth in advertising. When you pay money, take your kid to the zoo to see a lion, you expect to actually see a lion. A zoo in central China did not live up to its claims. Its supposed African lion got caught barking. The animal was, in fact, a Tibetan mastiff, just with a really fluffy mane. Needless to say, customers were not amused, saying the zoo was trying to cheat them. There was also a fox posing as a leopard and a different dog in a wolf pen. Guys, come on. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow sank 225 points, or 1.5%. The NASDAQ fell 63 points, 1.7%. And the S&P 500 lost 24 points, 1.4%. John Buckley, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.